Morning. My friend Sean Strube was born and raised in Iowa City. He now lives and works in New York and in Milford, Pennsylvania. I could take the full time to tell you the things that Sean has done. He has been HIV positive for 33 years. He is constantly involved in some worthy cause. He has raised millions of dollars for gay and AIDS-related charities. When I first heard of Sean, it was Norman coming home from the legislature and telling me about this cute page over in the Senate side. So my initial reaction was a little negative, but then I met him help me, Sean.
Alan
Barron, who was a gay man from Sioux City, who was involved in the McCarthy campaign back in 1968, and then moved to Washington and became a very prominent political commentator on CNN and PBS, and was Sean's mentor. Sean and Al Barron together wrote the first fundraising letter for the Human Rights Campaign Fund, and Sean took it to Tennessee Williams and got Tennessee Williams to sign it. If you saw a picture of Alan, you would know why Sean took it instead of Alan. But Sean he's run for Congress as a man with HIV. He has just done one thing after another, and his latest campaign is something that's near and dear to my heart, and that is the decriminalization of HIV men having sex with other men, which I know some of you have some reservations about, as I did at the beginning, but I don't anymore, and so I will let you be convinced by Sean.
Let me just say for the record that 38 years later, this page and others are still in somewhat in terror of Norman Jesse. He was an intimidating presence to a 16-year-old. For me, as a native Iowan, it's remarkable to come here and to see this breakfast club and see all these people show up this morning, and I can't help but think of some of the history that helped make that possible, including Dan's coming out in 1985, that I think ended up on the front page of the Des Moines Register. And I can quote the speech, but I won't do that. And Jonathan Wilson's coming out 20 years ago. All these individual little steps sort of lead to where we are, and it's kind of cool.
I forgot to tell you that Sean is the founder of Paws Magazine, which is the main source of information for people with HIV. I forgot to tell you about that.
Thank you. So thanks to everybody for having me here, particularly Jonathan for inviting me. And I also want to point out a couple of other people here. Tammy Haught, who is from Chain and who is leading the statewide effort to reform the criminalization statute in Iowa. Randy Meyer from the Iowa Department of Public Health, who has been amazing not just in this effort in Iowa but nationally because of his role with the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors. And Joseph Glazebrook over there, who with Dan represented Nick Rhodes, which I'll tell you more about in a second. The issue of HIV criminalization, first of all, to define what we refer to as criminalization, it is, I sort of describe it in two ways. One are HIV-specific criminal statutes, so criminal laws that are passed that only apply to people with HIV, nobody else. And this is what I refer to as creating a viral underclass in the law based on an immutable characteristic. And the other is when people are charged under other criminal statutes for, say, an assault charge or a prostitution charge or an immigration charge or other things, and the charges are heightened or the punishment is heightened simply because they have HIV. That's what we call HIV criminalization. Most of these statutes were passed at a time when what we know today is much different about the real risks and consequences of HIV transmission. or passed at a time of great fear with an intention to reduce HIV transmission. The evidence is growing that they're actually doing the reverse, that the statutes are contributing to the spread of the virus. I'm going to show a quick video and then want to say a word about what is going on in Iowa specifically. But before I do that, I want to say some survey research from the University of Minnesota shows that about two-thirds of gay men think that these criminalization statutes are a good idea. So if you're sitting there, you know, sort of jammed around this a little bit, that's okay. I'm just asking you to open your minds a little bit, understand it on sort of a new level, and what I found is that an awful lot of people, their thinking on this issue evolves pretty quickly when they start to look at it. So with that, I'm going to just show a video of about three people who have been prosecuted on criminalization charges. One of them we have with us today, we'll hear from in just a moment, and hopefully that will give you a little better sense of what it is that we're talking about. And kind of a jerry rigged sound system.
The only thing I can say is, you need to get a condom. I had so many thoughts going on my head when I was sitting in court. Like, you know, what if I walk out and so many people walking around calling me a monster? What if I get labeled a sex offender? What if they take my kids away from me? If convicted, I was in that state 12 years. And
if convicted, then the sentence would be anywhere from 0 to 10 years, or 25 years.
The Attorney General is arguing one should be held indefinitely under a no-act and civil confinement.
New York State wants to find another way to keep them behind bars permanently.
I felt like I went out with a whole bunch of people. They made me feel like.
One thing I always told myself, and I share with others, that I would never end up at a police station. I would never go to jail because I felt like I was always a law abiding citizen. My mother had a very young age. 12 when she was even 13, she had 8 months. So I always say that I'm before my time. So y'all.
So those three people, Nick, Robert, and Monique, were the first three people I think, in the world to have gone public about the experience they went through with HIV criminalization. Most people this has happened to, the last thing they want to do is to talk to a camera or to the media, because they've been, you know, in their press they've been called AIDS monsters, AIDS predators. You know, it's a horrifically humiliating experience. HIV transmission occurs in a very small number of these cases, certainly less than 10%, maybe less than 5%. In Iowa, charges have been filed, I think, 30-some times. I think there's only been transmission in a couple of the cases. I think that involves about 25 different people. So these cases are not about HIV transmission. They're about the inability of someone to prove that they disclosed in advance of having intimate contact with someone else. The challenge with them is a number of things. First of all, no one, in my view, should ever put someone else at risk of harm. You know, that's just that's just human. That's just sort of a basic consideration for other people. But these prosecutions have little to do with whether or not there is a harm present or not. Many of the prosecutions are like with Nix, where condoms were used, where the person had an undetectable viral load. They aren't about harm. The statutes imply a disproportionate responsibility for HIV prevention. They undercut the most basic message about sexual health, which is that ultimately people have to be responsible for themselves. They have to know their own behavioral boundaries and enforce them. And these statutes imply that it becomes somebody else's responsibility. They value the illusion of privacy, the illusion of safety for people who don't know their status or who are negative over the privacy right of the person who is positive. I ask people, which is the more irresponsible act? Someone who is positive, who doesn't disclose, but engages in behaviors that are not at any measurable risk of transmitting HIV. They have an undetectable viral load. They use a condom, but they don't disclose. Is that more irresponsible, or is it more irresponsible for somebody who's never been tested to be having sex with somebody, or somebody who doesn't even ask or bring up the topic of HIV before a sexual encounter with someone? The statute is horrific public health policy, and this is why you're seeing public health departments like Iowa's and others getting so engaged in this, because you can't be prosecuted if you don't know you're positive. So they discourage people from getting tested. And this is why we're hearing take the test and risk arrest in certain places, particularly when there have been a lot of high-profile prosecutions. And when the most difficult demographic to get tested is also a demographic that is at the most dramatic risk of HIV infection, young African-American men who have sex with men, many of whom have already had an unpleasant interaction with the criminal justice system, it is a terrific disincentive for them to get tested. Every person with HIV is now one disgruntled ex-partner away from finding themselves in a courtroom. We did a survey at PAWS. We know that a number of these cases are revenge cases. They're, you know, it's a bad breakup, like what Robert Suttle had. We also know some of them are just about a genuine miscommunication. We did a survey at PAWS several years ago, and about 2,000 people responded to it. And it was about all sorts of issues. And one of the questions was, have you ever had a circumstance where you believed you had disclosed to someone before being intimate, and afterwards you discovered the other person didn't think you had disclosed? Not in legal context, just in the course of their personal life. And 28% said, yeah, that had happened to them, because people talk past each other. You know, they use a vernacular that the other doesn't understand, or, you know, sometimes people can be willful about not hearing something. So we know a lot of the cases are revenge cases. A lot of the cases are honest miscommunication. Some of the cases are, with all due respect to my former prosecutor friend Dan, have to do with politically ambitious prosecutors sort of feeding a bloodthirst to the public to do something, and, you know, to beat up somebody with HIV, which the public seems to have a great appetite for. Iowa, unfortunately, has been one of the leaders in this phenomenon worldwide. About two-thirds of the states have HIV-specific statutes. Iowa is one of them. The United States is leading this phenomenon worldwide. And several years ago, an effort commenced globally through the United Nations and other global agencies to start to reverse this trend. And Iowa is, I don't want to quite say on the brink, but we're pretty close to the brink of seeing some change here in Iowa. Iowa might become the very first jurisdiction anywhere in the world to repeal its HIV-specific statute. And that is where Tammy Haught comes in and the effort that is underway here and why your interest and engagement in this is so critical. Calls to your legislators about this issue, even just asking them to look at the issue, to try and understand it. You know, you don't even have to get to a position of taking a position on any legislation or anything like that, saying this is something that needs to be addressed. The sort of trajectory that I find helpful to explain to people sometimes is that first, almost everyone, when we tell them about these cases, and like Nick's case, you know, 25 years in prison and lifetime sex offender registration for a circumstance where you used a condom, you had an undetectable viral load, and there was no transmission, people, well, yeah, that's ridiculous. That doesn't make sense. That's disproportionate to any kind of harm. There's a man, Willie Campbell, is serving 35 years in prison in Texas right now for spitting at a cop. You know, Carrie Thomas, we have a bunch of these videos on our website at saroproject.com. Carrie Thomas in Idaho is 3.5 years into a 30-year sentence for a woman he had been dating who went back to her old boyfriend and has claimed that she didn't know that Carrie was positive. And even though she acknowledges he always used a condom, and his medical records show that he was undetectable, but he's serving 30 years in Idaho. So disproportionate to any harm. The second sort of stage of progression is this point about creating HIV-specific statutes around an immutable characteristic. Most people agree that it's not a good idea to create different laws for different people based on the color of their skin, based on their sexual orientation, based on their gender, based on their genetic makeup. And yet, here we are creating a different set of laws for people based on a virus that they carry. And most people, when they think about that, yeah, maybe that does make sense. But then they say, but it should be regardless of the sexually transmitted infection. People will say, well, it should be all sexually transmitted infections. And that's really ultimately the question. What is the role of the criminal law in the context of sexually transmitted pathogens, where it requires you to take a volitive act of your own to be exposed to that risk? It's not a public health question of like protecting people from tuberculosis that you might get in a public conveyance, right, in an elevator or going to work on the bus or something like that. This is something that you have to make a decision on your own to engage in the behavior. What is the role of the criminal law there? And my view is that there are four things that should be considered when looking at that. The first is the state of mind of the person. Is there intent? Is there a malicious intent to harm? Someone with a malicious intent to harm, you know, that I think should be a crime. Second, how much risk was there? You know, all these prosecutions where there's no risk of transmission. Actually, the National Health Service in the UK the other day put out a statement that that essentially says that having an undetectable viral load provides less chance of HIV transmission than using a condom. There are all sorts of other reasons to use condoms that are very good, but how much risk is there? That should be considered when creating law around this. The third is what kind of harm was actually inflicted, if any. And fourth, like harms must be treated alike. You can't just take this one virus and create law around that, because this virus is associated with an outlaw sexuality. It's associated with gay men and with anal intercourse and with people of color and with people who use drugs. There are all sorts of other things that are sexually transmitted that are dangerous, and a number of which, if left untreated, can kill people. There's strains of human papillomavirus that cause all sorts of cancers. About 40,000 women died in the US last year of cervical cancer. Almost all of them got it from HPV, human papillomavirus, genital warts. There's hepatitis. There are other kinds of things. But we don't create, Iowa doesn't have an HPV criminal transmission statute. But we do have an HIV criminal transmission statute. that has nothing to do with transmission, as I said. So this is a very complicated issue. Going in and trying to educate legislators about this is a challenge. Matt McCoy has been unbelievably supportive over several years on this, so we're not starting from scratch in this legislative session. But I can't tell you how important it is. You know, if those of you who've been involved in advocacy at the legislature know that, you know, two or three phone calls or emails can attract the attention of a legislator and getting them to spend a few minutes to look at something. And that's what we need. We need legislators contacted and to get alerted to this. So with that, I want to introduce Nick Rhodes, and maybe he'll tell you why he's not serving that 25 years in prison that he was sentenced to, and then we'll do some Q&A for as much time as we have. Thank you very much. And this is... I just want you to understand how courageous it was for Nick to go public on this when he spent several years trying to get this out of his life. When is this going to be over, he would say. And he's now traveled internationally and has become sort of a poster boy for this issue, far beyond Iowa, but is also one of the main reasons we have action happening in Iowa as well. So, Nick Rhodes.
Thanks, Sean. Good morning. I'm not very good at preparing things for occasions like this, but I guess I was just thinking back to a few years ago, and at this very time I was having one of its coldest winters on record, and I was in the Blackhawk County Jail sleeping on cinder blocks, which are basically like a big sheet of ice, and eating breakfast not nearly as delicious as this. So I have to say my life is improving, my company. I'm keeping better company these days. But I have to point out, I am out on reconsideration. My conviction still sticks. I am obviously appealing my conviction. I did plead guilty. And I have to give great thanks to Dan Johnson and Joseph Glazebrook for taking that case years ago when it was very unpopular and there was not a lot of hope that it was going to get off the ground, but they believed that something could be done and they wanted to help. And Joseph, I think he stopped billing me a long time ago, so I'm kind of, he's a very good person to the point where he's going to end up in the poorhouse. But I owe both of them a great deal of gratitude. And as of now, I am with Lambda Legal, as well as Joseph and Dan, fighting it at the Iowa Supreme Court level. So we're waiting for that to be heard and see what the end result will be. I think other than that, I think my big head pretty much told you all the other details you might want to know.
Mr. Q&A?
Thank you.
Questions? Sure.
At the introduction, it was, I think you brought up that you were emphasizing decriminalization. Are all the laws really just pointed towards gay people, or is it HIV transmission? Because that one instance was a straight couple.
Right.
I guess so. I maybe it's not public enough for everyone knowing about it versus just gay people.
Right. The statutes aren't specific to gay people. They're specific around HIV. And honestly, for a long time, most of the prosecutions were African-American heterosexual men. And the prosecutions and a lot of the public's opinion around this has been shaped by hysterical media coverage of a few very, very high-profile cases that, you know, were very often race-driven in the coverage with a dark mugshot, and you know, somewhere in the background you're hearing about a dozen 13-year-old blonde virgins or something like that. These really wildly distorted kinds of cases that have shaped the public's perception. And the truth is, those cases also exist. you know, not in great numbers, but there are people who show an incredibly reckless, you know, disregard. There are, you know, circumstances where a person can become, you know, a one-man epidemic. In most of those circumstances, in my view, the most salient illness is not a viral one, but it's a mental illness. But unfortunately, those cases have disproportionately shaped public policy around them. Yes?
When you're talking to legislators, like, what really set a light off for me was when you mentioned the HPV virus. Do you see a light go off in people when you bring that up? Like, oh, God, 47,000 women die of a disease we don't even think about.
Right. Exactly. You see the light come off. When I'm speaking a little more formally with groups of women, I always tell my host, I said, now you watch when I say HPV and watch people's faces. Because about, you know, 70-75% of the sexually active adult population carries strains of HPV at one time or another. And literally people's faces in the room change. They suddenly think of, oh. So, yes, that's... Here and then here.
Okay. Oftentimes they use as a reason to repeal this law that it would encourage people to get tested. In the states that there's not a law, are there any statistics if more men are getting tested?
There's not good evidence around that. That's sort of an evidence base that's just now being being built. There have been some things. In fact, Sero, my organization, we did a big survey last summer through Eastern Michigan University of several thousand people with HIV in the U.S., and we found that a quarter of them said that they knew people who were afraid to get tested for fear of being criminalized. There's not the awareness of these statutes varies a lot by geography and by community. You know, you can go to some cases, some places where there have been a lot of prosecutions that have gotten a lot of local press, and people are aware of them. You go other places and people are hearing about it for the first time because they never had heard about it. So, excuse me. The extent to which it's...
Prosecute him.
Well, this will look like that was a setup. Nebraska, a year and a half ago, Nebraska passed a statute making it a felony for people with HIV to sneeze or to vomit in the direction of a law enforcement officer. That is intended to deal with you know, people in prisons and so on that are accused of doing that with an intent. Not very attractive behavior, and certainly, you know, probably when there's such an intent there, appropriate for some sort of prosecution. But a felony? It's not going to transmit HIV. It's unpleasant, and probably should be wrong. I mean, it should be a crime, but it makes it a felony. But to answer your question, no, there's not a study that I know of that directly relates it to testing behaviors yet.
So why are you using that as a primary argument?
Because what we do know is that stigma is the biggest obstacle to getting tested. And we know that this is the most extreme manifestation of stigma. When you put it in the law, when you create a different law for people based on their viral status, that is highly stigmatizing. And you can also speak to testing counselors. We're hearing it anecdotally all the time, you know, coming up, and people with doing prevention outreach, and where it's increasingly being cited at a community level by people as a reason not to get tested. But there aren't academic studies that I know of yet that show that correlation. Yeah.
I assume this is your brochure.
Right.
So I'd like you to talk a little bit about it, particularly the acknowledgement on the back, and then educate me. Sero, was that correct?
Right.
I've heard of the term Sero sorting. Educate me, or perhaps all of us, on what this term means.
Sure. We chose Sero, Sero positive, Sero sorting, Sero as something broader than just HIV. That it really is about creating laws based around the components in your blood, viral components in your blood, because this is applicable to people with hepatitis or people with HPV or all sorts of other things. So that's where the word came from. And the brochure provides some sort of general information about the issue, a few of the specific cases, and then tips for people with HIV on how they can protect themselves. And the disclosure statement on the back, which I had terrific help from Joseph Blaisbrook in drafting, is not totally original. The AIDS law, Louisiana, has been using such a form for some time. And we've heard anecdotally of people using them elsewhere. It is quite frankly demeaning and degrading as a person with HIV to think that you have to go through this kind of documentation.
It's not very sexy either.
It's not very sexy. No, it's not. The fact is there are a lot of people who live in significant fear around this issue, and legitimately. You know, the whole issue of disclosure is... varies a lot by community. There was a woman in Texas last fall, another woman, who was killed after disclosing to her boyfriend. He said, well, she murdered me by not disclosing, so I murdered her. You know, disclosure can be very, very dangerous. You know, for a long time, you know, those of you, you know, my age and older, you know, disclosure used to be something very private. You know, it was actually very common for people to be counseled by their physicians and by others not to disclose. That was a very personal, private sort of decision. And in recent years, disclosure seems to have, you know, mutated into what many people believe is that's a primary prevention strategy. And I think it's great when people are able to disclose. And I've spent a lot of my life trying to create a safe environment for people to disclose. But wagging your finger at somebody and prosecuting them and creating all these penalties for non-disclosure does not facilitate disclosure. It actually does the reverse. It drives people further into the closet about their HIV status. Most people don't disclose, don't find out they're positive and go out and start disclosing that day. You know, they are in a state of semi-shock. They need to adjust to this. They need to deal with this. In the old days, we used to have support groups. We used to have people with AIDS coalitions and organizations and body power, all these different groups, where people who were positive created a community themselves and had the support to begin to start to disclose. Most people with HIV can more easily disclose to someone else with HIV first, and so we don't have that anymore. So we expect people to get this news and to walk out of that testing center and suddenly be disclosing to their partners, and it doesn't happen that way. You know, people can say it should happen that way, but it doesn't happen that way, and it's not going to happen that way, and a law isn't going to make it happen that way. The law just makes the stigma worse, makes it more difficult for people to disclose, discourages people from getting tested. It doesn't do anything to protect public health.
Yeah. I was just going to bring up the point that you just discussed, is that when you first are diagnosed, you know, it takes a while just to wrap your head around. It doesn't happen overnight that all of a sudden you have all these great understandings. And, you know, especially, you know, I remember when I was diagnosed, you know, there was nothing in the Des Moines area at that point in time. I got it over the phone saying you're positive. Thank you for being tested. Boom. That was it.
Well, and look at who's being diagnosed today. You know, everybody in this room, you know, you've had some number of years of awareness around the issue and everything. But, you know, people getting diagnosed today, they're very young. You know, they've only had abstinence-only education in their schools. They don't know anything about it. They don't know the difference between HIV and AIDS. I literally had somebody at a college talk a few months ago, and it was, you know, you hear this, and you don't want to, like, look so astonished, but it was a kid who had tested negative and thought that meant he would always be negative. Oh, I've taken the test. I'm negative. He was just like this, and we started talking. And it dawned on me, he realized that what he was thinking is, this is a person in college. So the people who are at greatest risk of acquiring HIV and are being tested today, their knowledge base is vastly different than yours. Other questions? Yes?
You just sort of spoke about HIV versus AIDS. Can you comment further on, is there a difference in your mind or in the criminalization of someone who is knowledgeably AIDS-infected versus HIV?
Right. In terms of the prosecutions, there's never been a distinction that I know that's been made. You know, it's just whether or not you have tested positive for HIV antibodies or not. So the answer is no, in the law it doesn't make any difference. In terms of, you know, infectiousness, it's not really so much whether you have an HIV diagnosis or whether you have progressed to a stage where it's, you know, legally and medically considered AIDS. It, you know, the degree of risk is the amount of virus you have floating around in your system. It really relates to your viral load. Yes?
Yeah,
then here.
I read in regard to that risk factor, I read in the New York Times that if someone is on meds and are down to an undetectable viral load, it said it's virtually impossible to pass anything on at that point. Is that what other evidence was shown?
Well, yes, is the answer to that. It is as close to virtually, as close to impossible as you can get and still have it not be quite there. I have been for some time going around saying there's not a single case in the medical literature of, you know, which is a vast literature around HIV transmission, of someone who is known to be have an undetectable viral load who transmitted the virus sexually. Now, I am aware of there is a case in Germany. It is a suspect case. There are all sorts of reasons to think maybe the person actually wasn't, they aren't as certain that he was undetectable as would be nice. But no, people who have an undetectable viral load are not transmitting this virus sexually. A lot of you may have heard about the 052 trial that reduced the risk, showed that if you were on treatment, it reduced the risk of transmission by 96%. Anybody has heard that statistic? And actually, if you, the 4% were people who had not yet reached an undetectable viral load. They were transmissions in the very beginning of the trial when they had just started their treatment. So if you took those transmissions out, it actually would have been 100% reduction. The Swiss Federal AIDS Commission, several years ago, issued something called the Swiss Statement that said under certain circumstances, namely when the person who's positive had been undetectable for at least 6 months, the couple was monogamous, and there were no other sexually transmitted infections involved, that they could not transmit the virus. They actually said it in absolute terms that they could not transmit the virus based on their review of the literature. Most of the literature available then was on heterosexual couples. There are all sorts of reasons to look at that, you know, the study more carefully. But in essence, no. And this is the in the UK, just in the last 10 days or so, there was this news statement around this that said that having an undetectable viral load, there's less risk of transmitting the virus than actually using a condom because there's a breakage factor with condoms. So there are all sorts of reasons to use condoms, but HIV is not the only thing to be concerned about, but just in terms of the HIV transmission. Yes? Any other questions? Okay.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank
very,
you
much.
Very much.
It is a remarkable quest that Sean is on to address this dilemma in which people find that they are facing the prospect of either being infected with the virus or being infected with the knowledge that they have the virus. And I would venture to say in states like Iowa, being infected with the knowledge is as disruptive or more disruptive to a person's life than being infected with the actual virus. And it's a real challenge, and we wish you well. I've known Sean for a long time, actually. When I was making my last run for the school board, Sean had a fundraising event for me in New York City, no less. So I'm pleased to be able to reciprocate now, 18 years later, and provide him a venue for his fundraising event next Tuesday. If there are those of you who are available to come to the office, my office next Tuesday at 6 o'clock, that would be great. Nick, are you going to be there on Tuesday? Great. Tammy?
People don't have to pay. They just want to come and learn where that's fine, too.
There you have it. So another opportunity for free food and liquor.
Why your lawyer is going to fill out tax returns.
That's great. So you have that opportunity. I hope you will take up the offer. We have some great speakers upcoming for those of you who are thinking maybe you'd like to come back to this event. In March, Greg Gross from the Central Iowa AIDS Project is going to be here to talk about some recent developments with the project and its future and its plans. In April is Gautam Rathavan, who is the White House liaison to the LGBT community here in the United States. In May is another Sean Faircloth, who is the executive director of the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Science and Education. And in June, when we will have all of our scholarship recipients, and at this point we are on track to raise enough money for 12 of our scholarships. In June, our speaker will be Jason Glass, the director of the Iowa Department of Education. So there are some preeminent speakers coming up of caliber similar to the one you heard this morning, and we hope you will be here. And Sean, I will mention that it is our tradition to give a token of appreciation to our speakers, and the tradition is a copy of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus, and so I'll have that for you here this morning. And with that, we will adjourn, and thank you very much. Look forward to seeing you in March.